Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And as we said before the break, the second surge is here.
The trends obviously are going in the wrong direction and show no sign of changing.
That's Governor Baker on Tuesday referring to a significant uptick in coronavirus cases in Massachusetts. At the same time, there was promising news this week as Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company, announced that their experimental COVID-19 vaccine was more than 90% effective in the first batch of data for their phase 3 clinical trials. So let's talk about the latest on the coronavirus with a panel of medical experts. And you can call us. What do you need to know? Whether that's about the timing and availability of the vaccine, hospital capacity, sources of the current spread, call us with any of your questions. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us now for this conversation is Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases. He's also an associate professor at the BU School of Public Health. We also have Dr. Paul Sachs. He is the clinical director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctors Gill and Sachs, welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for inviting us. Thanks.
All right, so Dr. Sachs, I'll start with you. Cases are up. State officials confirmed 1,840 new cases of the coronavirus yesterday. At the height of the first wave in the spring, we were seeing around 2,300 a day. We have gotten close to that number in the last few days. The governor has confirmed that we're in the second wave. So what's your reaction to the numbers that we've been seeing and where we are?
Well, the numbers are up for a few reasons. One is that we're testing a lot more, and that means that the people being diagnosed have a wider range of illness. Some of them are quite sick and in the hospital, but many of them are quite well and still in the community. So that's one reason why the numbers are up. The other reason is that some of the very careful social distancing we were doing, and that was more easily done in the summertime when we were outdoors more, has not come to an end, but has been reduced. You know, when the weather gets cold, people move inside and there's just much more interaction, and that we know that that's how this virus spreads. So indoor activities are predominantly where they spread, and indoor activities are going to be more common as the weather gets colder.
So Dr. Gill, I'm going to turn to you because at the same time, what we haven't seen is a significant spike in deaths from COVID-19 the way we did in the spring. At the height, we were seeing over 180 deaths a day. I want to note the number's now hovering around 20, and any death is a death too many. But I want to play some sound from Carlisle Public Schools today. Governor Baker was there at a press conference saying the state is more prepared for this fall surge.
We're nowhere near the uncharted territory we were at in the spring. Nowhere near it. Nowhere. We are definitely dealing with a surge that we talked about throughout the summer and the beginning of the fall, and we're currently the largest per capita tester in the United States.
How does this, what seems to be a reduction in the death rate, relate to that preparedness, or what else is going on?
Yeah, so I completely agree with what Paul just said a moment ago about the increased testing rates, because that actually is clearly playing a role here, because if we look back to, you know, earlier in the spring, we were seeing test positivity rates in the 5%, 6%, 7%. Range. And at the same time, we were seeing very high hospitalization rates and lots of people were dying, as we all recall those terrible months in the beginning. And, you know, what we were almost certainly seeing there reflected in the testing numbers was that we were preferentially testing a sicker sort of stratum of the population. We were testing for cause because people were coming into the hospital sick and were being diagnosed with COVID-19, whereas now, you know, we're doing mass asymptomatic screening. I took my daughters to Revere, to the parking lot behind Revere High School the other day, where we all sat in our SUVs and waited to be tested one after another. And so the way that we're looking for the disease is fundamentally different. But even with that said, it's also inescapable that the COVID numbers are rising. And about a month ago, I think I discussed this issue with some of your colleagues. And at that time, the hospitalization rate had stayed pretty low, but that is also rising too. So we're not just seeing sort of an abstract number of rising cases solely due to our better testing capacity, but also because the transmission rates are definitely on the rise themselves, but not to the level that we saw in the spring so far.
All right, so Dr. Gill, Dr. Sachs, the calls are coming in already, so I'm going to turn there. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus question. We've got Bennett on the line from North Andover. Bennett, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher in Massachusetts, and it seems like right now many districts are trying to avoid going remote at all costs and, in fact, are working in the opposite direction to try to get students back full time. I'm wondering, from a professional standpoint, what is your opinion on reopening schools during the middle of a spike like this?
Dr. Sachs, would you like to start?
Sure. I think it's important that we consider schools based on the age of the students. It does appear that younger children are both less likely to get very sick with COVID-19 themselves and also, based on multiple studies, less likely to transmit it. We can contrast this with the older students, in particular, the older teen students and the young adult students in universities, and there they have very, very high rates of infection. So where possible, I think it does make sense to try to keep schools open, especially at that younger ages, and to do so with as many mitigation strategies as possible to make it as safe as possible. So, you know, there's a real societal cost to closing schools, and if we work together, I think we can make opening schools safe.
Dr. Gill, is there anything you want to add on that?
Well, I fully agree with Paul again on that point. I think there's such a huge social benefit in so many ways to having the schools open. And I really feel like that needs to be the number one priority above all other considerations. We need to keep the schools open. And I would add that, you know, I think we are promoting mitigation strategies in all sorts of ways. You know, we're asking the students to social distance, to wear masks, the faculty to wear masks. We're, in some cases, modifying the airflow within school buildings to increase filtration rates. Some teachers are putting HEPA filters in their rooms. Some may also be using UV filters. So we're doing all sorts of things to de-densify, to distribute the population, to maybe have alternating, you know, schooling. So half the students are present in school on every other week to reduce the transmission burden in the state. But the one thing that we're not systematically doing, with the possible exception of some of the universities, is systematic testing of asymptomatics. And I really do feel very strongly that we should be doing that, particularly in the higher transmission zones. And while I realize that there are significant resource implications to that, I think that, you know, if you think of all the efforts that we're going through in terms of risk mitigation and controlling transmission, the one thing is missing is evidence that we're succeeding. We have no barometer of success or failure. And so we're, in a sense, acting, you know, we're going into this blind. And that, to me, seems really, really a pity.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Stephen on the line from Hingham. Stephen, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. On October 25th, the Globe reported that the source of 50% of Massachusetts infections were unknown, meaning that 50% were known. Of the known sources, 30 to 37% were intra-household. The remaining 15 to 20% are ascribed to, quote, cluster-driven transmission like restaurants, schools, and private events. I'd assume that the 15 to 20% are reasonably representative of the unknown 50%. What are the details of this 15 to 20%? How much is gyms, restaurants, schools, et cetera? It seems like there's a lot of detail there that could inform how we manage the pandemic, but they just haven't shared the details.
Dr. Sachs, what do we know?
Well, there was a very interesting CDC study that came out that looked at cell phone data and tried to provide us with some better guidance about which were the riskiest activities. And really, number one are restaurants. And it's sad for me to say that because, you know, I love restaurants and I love going out to eat, but this is not the time to go out to eat in restaurants. I think we need to support our restaurants in other ways by doing takeout but not eating indoors. That really is definitely something that is high risk activity. So restaurants in particular, and then other sites where things like gyms and gyms in particular that have older ventilation or are crowded, and also unfortunately houses of worship and schools. If we were to prioritize which are most important for us as a society, I would agree that keeping the schools open is more important than keeping those other activities open, although everything is important. It's just a matter of can we try to avoid the biggest impact transmission sites, and restaurants and bars again and again come up as high risk.
You're listening to Radio Boston, where we're taking your coronavirus calls with Drs. Paul Sachs and Christopher Gill. The number for your question is 1-800-423-8255. We have Catherine on the line from Norfolk. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I come from a multi-generational family. We have kids in elementary school, middle school, high school, college. And everyone lives here in Massachusetts, but we are all in disagreement on how to celebrate Thanksgiving. My parents, who are in their late 70s, want to host Thanksgiving and want us to come. And I don't feel comfortable doing that, but other people in the family say that we should do it and we should honor their wishes. So I just want to know what the doctors think about that.
Catherine, thanks. And Dr. Gill, I'm going to turn to you, but I want to play a little sound to go along with Catherine's question, because the governor was a little more specific about where he's concerned with private gatherings today than I've heard him recently. He was referencing today a Washington Post article at this press conference he held in Carlisle. It's about what's causing the vast majority of the spread in the U.S. Here he is.
Dinner parties, game nights. It's the stuff I've been talking about for months now. Small, informal, casual gatherings with a bigger circle of friends than people were spending time with back at the beginning of the summer.
Seems like Catherine's question is about that bigger circle, this time family, not friends. What's your guidance for her?
It's a really important question, Catherine. And I don't think there's a very palatable answer. Except that to say that when we say, what is it about, you know, going to a bar that increases the risk? You know, the answer is really simple. It's risky because you're bringing lots of people together in close proximity for extended periods of time. They're probably talking loudly and therefore generating lots of aerosols. And, you know, they're drinking and engaging in social interactions, which are both sort of incompatible with masks, if you will. And they're in an enclosed airspace. And so it is really the perfect setting in which to transmit a respiratory virus of any kind. The only thing that distinguishes that from a Thanksgiving gathering is that you know all the people. And so I suppose there could be some comfort, you know, if everybody had been tested in advance. But that is very hard to really rest on in terms of having a high margin of safety, I would say. And the consequences, I think, if you could sort of imagine a worst case scenario coming out of this, where, you know, this you know, treasured family tradition leads to someone being hospitalized or possibly even dying, I can't imagine the sort of the psychological damage that would do to a family in terms of feeling guilty in perpetuity. So it just seems like it's a risk that is probably not worth taking. Unless somehow the weather, you know, conspired to be warm and unseasonably balmy, and the entire thing could be done outdoors. In that case, maybe you could justify this. But if this is an extended indoor dinner with lots of elderly relatives, it just seems to me like this is a very dangerous plan.
Thanks for that. Dr. Sachs, did you want to add?
Yeah, I think if you asked most infectious disease specialists the size of their planned Thanksgiving gathering this year, it would be very small. And feel free to ask me what mine will be.
So what will yours be?
It will be my wife and my son and myself, and plus our dog and cat. Really do.
Of course.
I have family that I would really love to see, and I feel for everybody. And we're going to miss that this year. But now that we have this exciting vaccine news, I think if we think about a light at the end of the tunnel, maybe not just with this one vaccine, but multiple vaccines, then this is a year we should sacrifice a big gathering.
I'm into that.
All right. There you go. 800-423-8255. Let's pick up John in Cambridge.
Well, yes. Hi, thank you. In support of opening up the schools, I heard your guest cite, quote, multiple studies indicating a relatively low risk threshold in the schools. My understanding is that those studies are quite partial, incomplete, and by no means unequivocal. Which specific studies are you talking about?
Dr. Sachs, that was you, so I'll turn back to you.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that there are studies that show that transmission can happen from children to adults. And what we're really talking about is not risk elimination, but risk mitigation. And there are all real downsides also to having children not go to school at all. So we're looking at trade-offs. And by and large, the highest risk people for transmission of the virus are young adults, and it's lower for children than it is.
Okay, let's take a couple calls. We'll go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Patty on the line from Westwood. Patty, what's your question?
Hi there. My question is regarding the Pfizer vaccine that is proposed to come out. When they say it's effective, certain percentage effective, what does that mean? Is it effective to stop the virus? Is it effective, I don't understand what that means without knowing details.
Thanks for that question, Patty. We've got another vaccine question. I'm going to get it too, and then I'll turn to both of you, Drs. Sachs and Dr. Gill. Jennifer's on the line from Everett. Jennifer, I think you have a vaccine question as well.
Yes, I have a question regarding vaccine distribution. I fully respect that frontline workers and possibly the elderly would be in line before me, but I am a cancer survivor, and I'm just wondering where I would possibly fall into, which phase I would possibly be able to receive the vaccine.
Okay, thanks for that, Jennifer. So, Dr. Gill, I'll turn to you with Patty's question first, which is, 90% efficacy with their first batch of data out of the phase 3 trial. What does that actually mean? What does efficacy mean here, and what do we take from that?
Yeah, I have to agree with Patty that the information that we got in the press release from Pfizer was a bit enigmatic. So what we were told was that the efficacy was based on the number of individuals who are identified as having COVID in the vaccine group versus the unvaccinated control group. And so that's what led them to say that there was a 90% reduction in infections. And so while that is reading a little bit into the tea leaves to some degree, because we only have that sort of rather broad statement, it does signal to me that we're talking about people being infected with COVID-19. Now, whether that was individuals who were identified because they were symptomatic and were thus tested and found to be positive, or whether this was based on some sort of systematic screening. So they looked at the whole population, with repeated nasopharyngeal sampling over time, and then eventually found, the numbers who became infected in the two groups. That was not clear in the press release, but it's a very important question, because one would like to know whether the vaccine is equally effective across the full spectrum of disease. Does it have an easier time protecting against mild disease versus severe disease? That's an excellent question. And of course, there are a number of other unknowns that I think really sort of tantalizing. How well does it work across the age spectrum? Do we have equal efficacy in the elderly or those with chronic medical conditions versus the young, hale, and hearty? That was not revealed.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn to you then, Dr. Sachs, for Jennifer's question. She was asking about kind of who's queued up in distribution. I believe that roughly phase one of distribution in Massachusetts, we're planning for 20,000 to 60,000 doses. She's a cancer survivor and wanted to know where she might be in the lineup.
Well, one thing that has been going on behind the scenes, which is really excellent, is that the CDC has providing guidance for distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. And they specify the four groups to be prioritized, which would be healthcare personnel, non-healthcare essential workers, not otherwise defined, and the states will define that. And then in that categories also are adults with high-risk medical conditions. And so, there are a variety of high-risk medical conditions that have been described for more severe COVID-19. It depends on the form of cancer that would whether one would qualify. And then the last category, of course, is people 65 years of age or older, because the elderly consistently in study after study after study have more severe disease. So that would be the first round of immunizations. But we hope, we infectious disease doctors are big fans of effective vaccines. We hope that pretty soon there'll be enough vaccine production for anyone who wants it.
When you say pretty soon, what do you imagine in your mind, Dr. Sachs?
Well, there's another study that is due to read out data within the coming week. I think we heard yesterday that they've had enough cases in the Moderna vaccine study to be able to say whether they have some signal of efficacy. And there are at least 8 other studies in quite advanced stages of investigation. And so we could have multiple vaccines available in the calendar year 2021. And the key then will be all of the logistics of distribution and then, of course, societal acceptance.
All right, we've got time for maybe at least one, maybe two. Let's start with one more call. We've got Luis on the line from Brookline. Luis, go ahead.
I am a board of director of the soccer league, adult soccer league, where we have about 275 soccer teams, more than 4,000 players, and we are playing. And even when we put very strict guidelines about wearing masks and all that, people are not really obeying to the guidelines. How dangerous is that? Like, what should we do in order to prevent more spreading?
Great question. Mm-hmm. Dr. Gill, do you want to, is that you I hear there?
Yes. I assume, Luis, that you're talking about outdoor soccer, in which case I think the data are pretty clear that the risk of transmission out of doors is really quite low. And I think one of the things that's really important to emphasize is that, we tend to think in a very simple way about the transmission patterns of this virus as being either, you're exposed or you're not exposed. But I think that's too simple, because really it's a matter of like the amount of the dose of the vaccine, of the virus that you were exposed to over time matters a great deal in terms of whether you become sick or whether you become infected. And if you become infected, what the severity of your illness was. So while I understand that, in a vigorous game of soccer, people are going to be, shoving up against each other and pushing hard, and will be in intimate contact for a few seconds at a time and breathing heavily. Even so, I think the risk of that presents is probably extremely low. And if you're also wearing a mask as much as you can, I think you've taken all reasonable steps. So I think that what you're doing is not unreasonable.
All right, let's try to get one more quick call and answer in. Luke from Cambridge. Luke, quickly, please.
I'm concerned that a coronavirus test too soon after a perceived exposure gives you a negative result, would give you a false sense of security. Doesn't it take a certain amount of time to build up a big enough load to read in a test, and shouldn't you continue to quarantine?
Good question. And Dr. Sachs, can you do a brief answer to that?
Sure. I mean, the answer to your question is yes. A single negative test done too soon after an exposure does not eliminate the chance that the person will get COVID-19 and be potentially contagious to others. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do the testing. And really what I've been advising people who are having kids coming back from the universities is to get tested before they leave, preferably after a period of 5 to 7 days of reducing social interactions, and then test it again once they arrive. And a couple of tests done, in fact, repeated testing is definitely, the models show that it is much more accurate than just a single test. But you're absolutely right to raise that concern.
Well, this has been great. That's Dr. Paul Sachs, the clinical director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's, and Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher, also at the BU School of Public Health. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invitation to join you today.